You're listening to ESBO International's School Business Insider. I'm your host, John Brucato. Each week on School Business Insider, I sit down with school business officials and industry experts from around the world to share their stories and explore the topics that matter most to you. Find out what it means to be a school business official and get your insider pass on all things school business. Welcome back, and thank you for tuning in to School Business Insider. Today, we're diving into a topic that sparks debate and controversy across the educational circles: school choice. From vouchers and charter schools to homeschooling and magnet programs, the landscape of education is rapidly evolving, and with it, the concept of school choice has become increasingly prominent. Today, I am joined by John Wilson, Chief School Financial Officer at Baldwin County Schools, located in Alabama, to speak on the potential implications of school choice and what school business officials need to consider as this topic becomes a growing legislative priority. John, welcome to the podcast. I'm happy to have you on.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, school choice is really becoming a hot button issue across the states. And I know it's really been bubbling up in Alabama. But before we kind of get into the meat of the conversation, can you just give our listeners a little bit of your background and just kind of the landscape of Baldwin County Schools?
Sure, absolutely. So I am kind of wrapping up my 11th year as the Chief School Financial Officer for Baldwin County. I came from a big accounting firm in Atlanta. I grew up here in Baldwin County. I'm a CPA, certified fraud examiner. Baldwin County's we have about 32,000 students here. About 46 schools. I believe we're the fastest growing county system in Alabama. Wow. Some of the areas are some of the I think from a metropolitan area, I think from perspective, we have the seventh fastest growth in the entire nation. So we're growing.
That's great. I'm sure that brings its own set of challenges outside.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. So we're, I think in the last 10 years, if you look at what we've completed and then what's, you know, in design right now, we're about $500 million of construction, trying to keep up with the demand and growth. And it's a good problem to have, but it definitely creates other kind of trickle-down issues you have to work through. But
yeah, I mean, a lot of the school business officials I talk to are struggling with declining enrollment, but it sounds like you guys are kind of on the opposite side. So that's great. But yeah, like you said, good problems to have, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I know we've been growing probably about 500-600 kids a year. So we're growing the equivalent of elementary school per year. So
that's crazy. On my side of the coin, I mean, we have declining enrollment. So to hear that you have a new elementary school every year is pretty wild.
That's crazy. Right. It's been good. I just need to kind of settle down and
slow down a little bit.
That's right. Right.
Yeah, I can't even imagine how much construction you're having to deal with year after year. Probably a whole nother episode's worth of content. But for today,
sure, absolutely,
I did want to kind of pick your brain a little bit about school choice. Can you maybe just give a synopsis of what school choice is and kind of how it's affecting school business officials and school districts across the across your state, and I guess maybe across the nation?
Yeah, so, school choice has been a kind of a growing topic across the nation. I feel like it's also kind of been very political, whether that's charter schools, whether that's voucher programs, whether that's education savings accounts. It has many different shapes, forms. You have many different aspects that are wide open and have created issues. You have some states that have put guardrails in place to try to, keep it, under control. And that's really kind of what I wanted to talk about. A lot of that is that, how can you take these things, put the right amount of guardrails in there to avoid creating a situation that has historically, and you can see the records and the reports, has created fraud,
right,
throughout the nation. We're currently in the middle of a big discussion right now in Alabama about expanding school choice through the voucher program. It's been brought up multiple years. This year, it's an improvement over what's been presented in multiple years, and that it finally has some guardrails and some caps on what can be taken out of the education trust fund from a financial perspective. The one last year was absolutely terrible. It had no accountability factors. I think it was a prepaid debit card of $7,000 per student. That was
really
insane. That had
so explain to me how that worked then. So did families got a $7,000 debit card that they could use towards tuition and school supplies for private and charter schools, or what was that?
It was called the Price Act last year, and it was a $7,000 debit card, and there was really no oversight or any other provisions that I was aware of that would have maintained it could have been used for certain reasons. And at least this one, there are some, you know, in this bill, of course, it's, you know, as a public school official, you always have concerns, but at least they put some provisions in there where there's testing accountability components into it. And I think they've set it at an initial cap to limit the exact exposure. There's some limitations on who can apply on the first year, even though I know the official draft right now that kind of phases out over a 3-year period. Right now, I think it's 300% of your federal poverty level you can apply. There's a certain percentage that goes to special needs students. Mm-hmm. I'm okay with that. I think one of the big issues, I think, when you look at this, and you know, a lot of the proponents are like, you know, the money follows the child and those type of things. The problem is that if you take away some of the income caps and some of the provisions which they use as a selling point in which to get the legislation passed, you realize that you have hundreds of thousands of students that have never set foot in a public school.
Right.
That would automatically qualify. You have homeschool students, and it's hard to find quantifiable data to see, you know, what the impact of that is. And I know that looking at it from, you know, as operating a school district, I think one of the concerns is that, you know, do they take the money and do they send it right back to the public school system? And so, you know, having the right, you know, guardrails and controls there, I think is paramount to make sure it's successful.
Yeah. And you said, as you were kind of describing the school choice program, there's really from what I've gathered, there's four different types. There's education savings accounts, which are public funds allocated to families for private school tuition, other expenses, and kind of has a wide range of eligibility criteria. Voucher programs are really popular. Again, public funds for private school tuition. The typical eligibility criteria is related to disability, school performance, income, things like that. The one that I, from what I understand, Alabama has is a tax credit scholarship, which is a scholarship for private school tuitions funded through donations to nonprofits. So it's not, from what I'm reading, isn't necessarily siphoning public money towards private and charter schools. It's privately donated. And then finally, there are tax credit education savings accounts, which are less common, but really is a variant of the education savings account where families receive funds through nonprofit organizations. So is that true? Is Alabama, are you grappling with the tax credit scholarship kind of model of school choice right now?
So that's been around for probably, I don't know, 7 or 8 years now.
Okay.
In that, you know, it's a dollar for dollar tax credit. And it's a tax credit from one of the main income sources that goes to funding education in Alabama as a whole there. You know, I think that there were some provisions in that where it was, you know, you had to be, you know, a priority school or certain type things, and you had the ability to apply for scholarships and that. And I think it's worked for the intent that they needed it to work.
Right, because it sounds like there are some guardrails up, right? As you were saying, it's not just kind of, you know, carte blanche on, you know, whatever people want to use the money for. There's certain criteria for those tax credits.
I think, you know, and I think one of the challenges with the tax credits as they set up is that if you give a student a tax credit in year one, I mean, the expectation is that tax credit is going to continue. They're going to continue to get the scholarship throughout their tenure at the private school. And I know that the financial implications of growing it and sustaining it are, you know, create some interesting challenges there. But just, you know, one of the interesting things, you know, you know, everyone always says, well, it's not going to impact education. The funding follows the child. And well, I mean, that's true to an extent, but I mean, you know, it's more complicated when you look at the expenses of running a school system. I mean, you know, if you have one student that leaves your system to go and, you know, join a private school or a charter school, I mean, you can't necessarily lay off 1/25th of an algebra teacher.
Right,
you can't sell 1/30th of a school bus. I mean, there's a lot of overhead costs that you still have to maintain and that you still have to keep. And You know, we're fortunate here in Baldwin County that we have the local support to maintain some of that. But there's a lot of districts in Alabama that are very rural, that are very that are struggling financially. And so, you know, as your enrollment continues to decline, your overhead cost continues to go up and up and up. And I think those are some of the conversations that are not being had. And so I think a lot of the proponents and the other ones that continue to make the statements of, you know, it's not going to impact public education, the funding follows the child. Have you ever been in a public school? Has your child ever been in a public school? Do you even know what you're talking about? Or are you just parroting the same information that they say right. over and over and over again without really digging into the facts? It is interesting, too. I pulled up an article that you had some public school districts that had their credit rating downgraded by Moody's and S&P due to charter schools enrolling in their district. And I thought that was really kind of an interesting circumstance. There, it was actually an article in Reuters here, but I mean, here you have a situation that's completely out of your control that has the financial implications to get downgraded from your credit. And so if you have future capital needs or you need to go to the bonding market or anything to that extent, you're impacted on that with things completely out of your control. And I think another big implication and one of the things that I've said, whether it's the Accountability Act or whether it's the voucher program now, the planning implications. For a local school district. So we're big in planning. You know, we're like I said earlier, we're one of the fastest growing school districts in Alabama. We're growing fast. So planning is key. And so we've got a lot of different metrics in order to try to project what our enrollment will be, looking at development, looking at, you know, cohort factors of survivability. From, you know, how many first graders make it to second grade, make it to third grade, and going right. all the way up the chain and looking at the waves. Some grades have a higher level of student population than others. And so taking all of that to try to plan for the next school year. So it creates another complicated aspect when you potentially have to plan and guess how many students are going to opt out to go to a charter school. But you also need to provide space if they come back in the middle of the school year. And I think that's one of the big things that I've said before. If you're going to do this, if you're going to do school choice, if you're going to give the equivalent of $7,000 per student, then you need to make sure they're there for the entire year. And you're not creating a situation where the money leaves the public school system to another entity only for them to come back mid-year. I know in Alabama, we have a very kind of small period of time in which our enrollment data is calculated for funding purposes. And so it's really 20 school days after Labor Day. And that's where they take your average enrollment. And that is the mechanism used to calculate how many teachers you earn, what's your admin, your counselors, nurses, social workers, those type things. And so you can kind of see at the beginning of the school year, if they're enrolled somewhere else, that's the mechanism used to generate your funding. And then they come back in January, you're having to account for that, you're having to deal with that, and you're getting zero funding to address that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, the beginning of the year is typically a very transient time for school districts. So right. are you seeing that as a challenge where there's a 20-day snapshot and your enrollment could be completely different 5 months down the road? I mean, has that historically been a challenge? And it sounds like it probably is getting challenging.
Been a massive challenge in Baldwin County. And you know, it goes even further than that, you know. So they take the 20 days after enrollment, and that basically is a snapshot that funds the next school year. And so, you know, and so for a growing school system, like we said, that's growing the equivalent of an elementary school per year, created some challenges being 1 year behind, knowing that these kids were coming in and the mechanism for state funding was a year behind. Luckily, you know, I've been able to coordinate with our state senator. We put some provisions in the calculation of the what they call the foundation program, which is the funding mechanism for education to help growing school systems. And so that has helped, but that's absolutely a challenge. And I think we've seen situations where, you know, everybody's making sure that you know, that the students are enrolled those 20 days, but after the 20 days, they're like, just kind of go transfer, do whatever you want. I mean, that creates some challenges from a planning implication from a school system side.
So does Alabama take into consideration any enrollment projections for the following year, or is it just that snapshot that's rolled forward into the following year for funding?
So previously, you know, and I actually was involved in writing legislation that kind of, you know, created a kind of a 2-year average model that could go and kind of help growing school systems by taking what the average growth is over a time period and applying that on the front end. In the past, they would be like, well, you know, let's look at your snapshot and let's look at your enrollment in January and let's kind of measure the difference together. The problem is that, you know, that was a separate line item in the Education Trust Fund budget. That was one, it was just kind of glaring. It was out there. And, you know, legislators, they grabbed that line item and they used it for startup charter schools. And so they were like, hey, you know, you grew another 500 students. We're going to give you the equivalence of, you know, maybe 30 more teachers or something like that, but we're only going to fund $2,000 a teacher.
Wow.
So I mean, it was, I mean, again, the concept was there, but it was never funded.
The money
was It was sitting out there. They're like, oh, let's look at this money. How about we do it through something that's going to help us politically, like charter schools. And right. So what we did is that we kind of helped with through legislation to kind of revise that process. Let's look at an average, let's take the growth, and let's do it on the front end. If you're if you're going to give me a couple $100,000 in January to hire teachers mid-year, which is very difficult to have, it's disruption when you're moving classes around, and it just doesn't make sense. And it just comes down to that. You want to generate the funding formulas to do schools, get the input from people who do it every day. And so I was happy to have, you know, some of our local delegation members listen to us, take input and take the lead in changing it statewide, which I think that alone has allowed us to hire, I think, you know, maybe like 300 additional teachers per year with some of the growing systems throughout Alabama. So that has been good, but you can kind of think, and, you know, I have some interesting stats here about, so many of the, not only if they come back, but so many charter schools that I'm looking at are not necessarily successful for the long term.
Right.
And so, you know, there was a 2020 report from the Network for Public Education Documents that kind of laid out a closure of such a large number of charter schools. And I thought some of this was interesting. It said within a 3-year period, 18% of charter schools nationwide had closed. Most of those coming within the first year. At the end of 5 years, 25% have closed. Within the 10 years, 40% of those charter schools have closed. So you not only have to deal with students coming, opting in and out during the school year.
Right, they're bouncing around, yeah.
They're potentially bouncing around. And if you have, you know, charter schools, you know, in your district that are closing, well, where are those students going to go? They're going to go back to your school.
Are you seeing those averages kind of take hold in Alabama? Does that track those stats?
It's hard to get stats. I mean, honestly, that's kind of part of it. I think some of the transparency around some of these schools is difficult to find. I think there have been some schools that I think have been kind of right on the bubble. You know, are they going to make it? Are they not? Those type things. And, you know, Alabama's relatively new into this arena. You know, we don't have a lot of, you know, and I'll get into this, you know, every, you know, charter schools sometimes like to call themselves nonprofit, but then they'll contract out with a for-profit charter school management company or something like that. And a lot of times they're owned by the same company. And so they play the shell game in order to play that game. And so, I mean, Alabama is relatively new into it. And, you know, I always made the joke. I was like, I don't know if you're going to, you know, if you look at the state funding in Alabama and if you get these for-profit charter schools to come in, are they going to make a profit margin?
Right. Yeah, what's the goal? Yeah.
Right. And, you know, if they're going to fund it the same way that they fund regular public schools, then, I mean, is that going to be, you know, it's not going to be quite the level. And there's been some attempts to try to differentiate that and do some other things that we continue just to kind of, you know, express our concerns about. But, you know, and I think, you know, some interesting things is not only the charter school. If you look at some of these virtual charter schools and you look at some of the funding that is happening to that, I mean,
So you have charter schools that are even brick and mortar. Is this a new thing out of the pandemic where virtual charter schools are popping up?
It happened, you know, this basically started to spread around pre-pandemic, and where you would have a virtual charter school that would kind of latch on to a public school, but it would be open statewide.
And so Alabama's education department doesn't have any issue with a virtual school?
I think it creates a lot of issues, especially when you provide the funding at the same level as a brick and mortar, regular county district. Are they getting money for transportation that they're not having to do? Or are they having to provide, or that they're not providing, the lunch programs? Are they having to follow FAPE and IDA and 504 and all those things? I mean, I think that's all questionable. So should they be funded at the same level of rate without having to deal with some of the mandatory provisions that we have to as a school? And so, and we've seen a lot of problems here. I know there was in North Alabama just relatively recently, there was a pretty public significant fraud case in that you had a virtual school operator that basically latched on to two different districts in North Alabama. And the scheme of what they would do is that they would provide laptops, and that laptop had a certain software program on it, and they would be like, hey, private schools, would you like a free laptop, and here's some software if you want to use it. What they were doing is they were taking the private school student information, and they were basically counting them as public school students. So they were taking their name, their information, their addresses, everything, and say, hey, look at the public school students that we have enrolled. And so at that point in time, the State Department kind of started sniffing it out. I kind of heard some rumors about it. I was trying to blow the whistle. I couldn't really. A lot of times people were like, John, you just need to shut up. And stop being a problem. But anyway, again, these rumors started happening. The State Department started questioning the student numbers, those type of things. So what did this virtual school program do? Well, the first step they did is that, what can I do to apply to be a public charter school? And why did they do that? Because of the lack of oversight and the lack of accountability there. And it probably would have worked in Alabama. That's what's so sad and frustrating, except that the feds came in. They investigated. I think not only were they grabbing children out of private schools, but they may have grabbing children out of juvenile detention centers and other stuff. Wow. And it resulted in, I think the superintendent up there had a $7 million, they're in jail right now, and there's multiple million dollars that have to be repaid personally. But it makes you question that, when it was very clear that they were manipulating the student numbers, they were manipulating the data, they were doing all of these type things. Their answer is that, well, we just need to be a charter school, because otherwise, we don't have to follow the same accountability and transparency provisions as public schools. And I think that's the major, major issue in the school choice movement. Charter schools can be, you have some very successful charter schools. You have some very successful areas if they're done right. I mean, the intent of that was to increase the flexibility, the innovation, or those type things. The problem is that it has been rolled out to such an extent that does not have what I call the guardrails. It does not have the accountability provisions from an academic and a financial to make it successful. Many states exempt charter schools from audits, from open meetings acts, from open records acts. They don't necessarily have to follow procurement requirements or bid law. You don't have the same training and qualifications for hiring your teachers. Is it the same background checks? A lot of these things are to protect the students. Like I said before, many of these operate in nonprofit from statewide organization or nationwide organizations that have multiple ones. And even though there's only one state that says it's allowed to be for profit, I think it's Arizona. Everybody else kind of gets around there with these charter management organizations that basically run the operational needs of the school, and get paid. So it's just it has created a problem. I mean, again, because of the lack of oversight and those type things, it has created a situation that is just prone for fraud and manipulation. I mean, I looked at a study, and again, feel free. I keep going on and on here, but I looked at a study that basically looked at some of the federal charter school grants. And there is a study, and it was done, I think, in 2019 by the Network of Public Education. And it estimated that approximately, 1.1 billion dollars in federal fund has been spent on charters that either never opened or opened and have since shut down. And then to drill down into those numbers, you see that it identified 537 charter schools received public finance governmental grants that never even opened one day.
And to think that money could have gone to schools that are actually operating, public schools that are supporting children throughout, you know, every state is just kind of mind blowing that that amount of money went basically nowhere, right?
Yeah, it's like, where's the outrage? I mean, you, again, you know, funnel that into the Title I program, funnel that into to the schools with the higher level of poverty, because Lord knows they need the help, they need the support, they need the ability to hire intervention teachers and tutors and those type things. Let's not create a fraud, a situation that's just going to open Pandora's box for people to take right. advantage of this. I know that if you drill into it, they said that I guess we can call them ghost charter schools, mm-hmm. that California 61 charter school operators pledged to open their schools, but never did, but still got federal funding to do it. Michigan,
which I don't even know how that works, right?
Exactly. I think about the audits and I think about the monitoring provision and I think about how hard they are with federal funds for us. I mean, it is just... the oversight and the accountability at the public school level. I mean, we're audited to the extent that no other governmental entity in the area, especially on the local, is audited right. like we are. I mean, we're audited every year by the examiners. We're monitored by the state. We got to submit financials every month through the state. And, you know, we got rating agencies looking at us. There's so many different entities looking at us. How can this happen without, you know, where's the outrage? You know, Michigan had 72 grant recipients that never opened their school. I mean, there was a story, I mean, in Michigan, that you had a private consultant and her company, they just hopped from one defective charter to the next, applying for grants and receiving them.
So it was like shell companies, right?
Like, well, that's exactly what it is. I mean, it's like shell companies. And so, I mean, you have this nationwide structure that lacks basic oversight that's created a breeding ground for fraud. And so, you know, to the tune of over $1 billion, which is absolutely staggering. And so, you know, I'm, like I said earlier, you know, I'm a CPA and I'm also a certified fraud examiner. And I think one of the interesting things, and I bring this up when I present to different people throughout the school, is that the fraud triangle and what is the fraud triangle? And so the fraud triangle basically is a model that if all three sides of the fraud triangle are connected, then you're going to have a high probability that you're going to have some problems. You're going to create incentives for people to take mm-hmm. advantage of the system and do fraud. And what is that? So, you know, one side of that is when motivation and pressure creates opportunity through a lack of internal controls, creates a rationalization of why you're doing this. When those three sides come together, it creates a perfect opportunity for fraud. And so you can see the pressure on one side. So, you know, you have these big, giant for-profit, you know, charter schools. Now, like, we've right. got to meet our numbers. We have, you know, we have corporate goals and expectations that we have to meet. There is the pressure. You have the opportunity. But many of these have no audits. They have no internal controls. There's no statewide or detailed oversight. They kind of find the volunteers to look over, you know, on some charter school board, but there's no really teeth into the oversight provisions there. And then you got the rationalization. Oh, you know, this is only short term, or, oh, these private school students, I mean, they're using some of our equipment and our software.
Yeah, and 5, 10, 15 years later, like, it's still going on.
And then you're running into a $10, $20 million fraudulent scheme there. And it could have all been prevented by having the appropriate oversight and accountability provisions. And that's what we say. But for whatever reason, you know, and that's why are the opponents so opposed to that? What are they, what are they doing? You know, what's really happening here? You know, there's another example of a charter school in Alabama. And I was looking at this situation, particularly in Montgomery County. And so, there was a situation, I'm going to get my notes. So there was an unanimous tipster that basically said the meals that are being reimported, that are being reported, are not accurate. So, you know, the CNP meals. So they're going to say these are the amount of the meals served. These meals are going to trigger a reimbursement rate back to the county. Those type of things. You had an anonymous tipster that basically said, I don't know if these are accurate.
Right.
And so it triggered an audit. That audit round up almost $2 million of additional federal CNP funds were claimed, but were never actually distributed through the lunch program.
So the charters can take advantage of this county program for school lunch just as a public school would? Is that correct?
It appears. Well, I mean, here's the interesting thing with that, and, you know, it goes back to are they held to the same level of requirements from a procurement standpoint? Because if you look at the food service provider mm-hmm. within this, that basically right now it's a, you know, it's the charter school fighting the food service provider, but the food service provider, he was number one, he was the sole bidder for it, which kind of raises some questions because, sure, again, you're not going through the same service providers that public education is doing, but it's ran by a pastor that's been convicted of previous fraud convictions there. So, again, you look at the fraud triangle.
Here, I was going to say, that triangle is getting bigger, right?
Right, and that's two, I mean, that's just a local Alabama example of a $2 million, and it's a good thing that the unanimous tipster did that, because that would have grown into God knows how much.
Right, right.
Between a charter school that doesn't have the proper controls in place, using a company that was never properly vetted to provide this, and now you're dealing with fraud. Again, it goes back to the fraud triangle. I mean, it created the pressure, the opportunity, and the rationalization, and you see fraud every single time. So
I want to bring it back to just kind of school choice in general and how public school business officials are potentially impacted, or maybe something that you're looking at in Baldwin County Schools. So I have a clip of Alabama Governor Kay Ivey's State of the State address that I just want to play for you. It's about 2 minutes long, but I just want to play a couple minutes of that and just kind of get your reaction.
The fact that during my time serving as your governor, together, we have invested a new historic amount in our public schools each year. This year, we will once again have the largest education trust fund in our state's history. We must also fulfill our promise to have the highest starting salary for our teachers among our neighboring states. Let's get this done this session. Improving our state's education system is a process, and we have to meet the needs of all students. As governor, I realize the way to do that is to make sure there are opportunities available for our children. For some families, that means having the chance to send their child to a charter, a magnet, or private school, or to homeschool them. School choice is a spectrum. And last year, we recognized that to expand our options in Alabama, we had to first improve our existing options, charter schools, and the Alabama Accountability Act. You accomplished that. Thank you. Next, our next step now is to provide our parents, beginning with those most in need, education savings accounts, which will further us on our journey to become the most school choice friendly state in the nation. Passing an education savings account bill that works for families and for Alabama is my number one legislative priority.
So there are a few points that she made in that State of the State address that I just want to kind of get your thoughts on. The biggest one, the biggest elephant in the room, I think, is her priority making education savings accounts universal for schools in Alabama. What do you see as the potential issue for public schools if education savings accounts start popping up throughout your state?
Well, I think the definition of universal is something that you have to drill down into. And I think with any type of governmental entity, if you don't have the proper guardrails, kind of what we've been talking about earlier, it's mm-hmm. going to create problems, and it's not going to fix the underlying issues that you're trying to do. And so, I mean, I think universal is a scary term. I think it's as scary making a statement of that nature at the time when, you know, you're dealing with, you know, record high revenue that's probably not going to be sustainable in the long term. So, I mean, are you creating an issue that's going to be able to be sustained over the long term there? And again, are you creating, I mean, do not connect all three levels of the fraud triangle and create more fraud in Alabama when you have schools that are in desperate need of the funding. And I think, and also to kind of look at some of this as well. I do think that there's a lot of political pressure to push this on the nationwide. And I do think the chairman of the Education Trust Fund, those guys have put together a good bill with that that actually has some guardrails in it. And again, you know, that, you know, I think if you're going to want to compare public to private, you need to have an apples to apples comparison on that. And that brings some of the testing accountability provisions. I do think there are some provisions that the schools that accept the vouchers have to, you know, have to comply with. And so, I mean, I appreciate the guardrails. And I think there was an amendment this week to set the cap on what it could exceed to. And so, okay. I mean, I think those, if you're going to do it with guardrails. The reality of this is that, you know, everyone likes to say, you know, these are to help children, you know, to find better opportunities. In some situations it is, but for the most part, the kids that really need it need transportation to school. Do the private and charter schools provide transportation? No, they don't. Do they do free and reduced lunch? Maybe some of the charter schools do, the private schools do not. And so, and then just looking at it outside of the educational realm from just an economic perspective, I go back to what happens when they added, you know, subsidies for electric cars, you know. Well, the electric car manufacturers increased the price of the electric car. So, I mean, you know, you're going to increase you're going to give $7,000, and what are the private schools going to do? Oh, sweet. You know, well, first of all, they're going to be like, if I'm going to have to follow some of the government bureaucracy, I'm just going to raise my tuition. Right. Or they're just not going to accept to do it. But anyway, it's just they're going to raise it. And is it really going to achieve what you wanted it to achieve? What's really behind this push? And why is there such a limited amount of transparency to figure out who's behind it? What are these organizations doing? What are the PACs that are contributing to it? Who's making the money? I mean, I don't know. It just kind of brings up a lot of red flags. But
you made an interesting point too on the expenditure side of the budget. You can't necessarily cut a 25th of a teacher or a 30th of a bus, right? But with these education savings accounts, is there any concern from the other side of the budget on the revenue? I mean, do you see the potential of state revenues being siphoned away from school districts, public school districts, towards these charters? And can you talk to me a little bit about that?
100%. You know, if the cap on who's eligible to receive these. So, I mean, if there's no right now on the first year, I think it was, you know, you can only apply for them if you were 300% above the federal poverty lines. And so if you kind of remove that as well, and it's open to anybody, it's universal. Well, I mean, I'm not exactly sure the exact number, but I think it's over 100,000 kids that have been in private school that have never set foot to a public school. And so all of a sudden you have the same pie, but you have someone taking a bigger chunk out of it. And I think the statewide implications of that, absolutely, it's going to be impactful. I know that when the coronavirus relief funding came up and ESSER funds and those type of things, and we had some very interesting, I guess, homeschool cluster, you know, people running schools in their basement, coming to us, demanding federal funds and people. Right. So, I mean, again, you just have to be careful when you set up something like that. It has to have guardrails. They really need to be accredited. You need to be able to follow the same testing provisions so you can monitor, are we properly expending our tax funds? Are we actually making a difference here? There's been a number of investments in Alabama done in what's called the Literacy and Numeracy Act through summer camps to target students that are behind in reading and math. And, you know, you're seeing a lot of improvements there. And so isn't that the direction we need to go as opposed to an area where the majority of the people that are going to apply for these are already in charter are already in private schools automatically? And, you know, people ask me, you know, in Baldwin County, you know, is that going to help? Is that going to hurt you locally and that kind of stuff? And, you know, I kind of joke and I'm like, well, I mean, in Baldwin County, the private schools are struggling with growth at the same amount that we are. And so if you want to go, there's probably a waiting list. There's challenges there.
Sure.
But I think of some of the rural, you know, higher poverty county districts in Alabama that don't necessarily have a lot of options, or there's maybe one option in there. And then if you go and you cut their funding, they're already dealing with some challenges with a lot of the ESSER and the ART funding that's going to roll off at the end of September. I mean, there's economic headwinds all over the place. We're making decisions right now with a record high at the statewide level. Are we making to cut taxes or create another initiatives there? Are we doing this in a way that can be sustained? And I'm not saying that we're not, and I think that we can, but I just think that every single decision has to be really scrutinized. And, you know, and again, these things can be successful, and there are certain, you know, private schools and charter schools that target particular demographic of students that I think can offer a level of support that a lot of public schools can't. And I think that's a very good thing. As long as you have the, you know, as long as you have
that transparency, right?
and make sure you can have the equity there, then it's going to be. But it seems like every time that's brought up, you see a kind of designated push to try to take that away. And I'm like, when you take that away, it's just going to create negative headlines like we've already seen in Alabama, whether in North Alabama or in Montgomery or those type of things, where if you would have had an annual audit, I mean, and held up to the same provisions as public schools, then you would have caught that on the front end and not have to you know, wait for, you know, either an anonymous tipster. And I think there was another situation where they asked the State Department, you know, for additional money. And one of the provisions was like, hey, we're going to need an audit if you're going to do that. The audit brought up some questionable things there. But why is that the case? You know, why isn't that just a regular provision? Why isn't, you know, everyone saying, hey, this is taxpayer dollars. We need to make sure it's used efficiently and effectively, because, you know, I know everybody's on me as, you know, managing, you know, $500 million budget, you know, with the third largest school system, Alabama, to make sure that we're accountable for every tax dollar that's being spent, that we can justify everything being spent, that, you know, that again, that we have transparency, we have the check register, we have our audits, you know, we have public budget hearings. What's the problem? If you're going to do this with taxpayer dollars, then they need to be held to the same standard as everybody else. And I think if you talk to a lot of our peers, that's really where they're going to go. But also, I think there needs to be some guardrails, because from a planning perspective, like I said before, if you have students moving in and out and those type of things, it creates a lot of logistical challenge to address it. If you have charter schools that open, kids move, they only last for a year, it closes, and you have a rush of students coming back into your school, it creates a lot of challenges, because we all know that I think every nationwide issue is teacher shortages.
Yeah, which I want to circle back on in just a minute. The issue of really planning and capital planning specifically. I mean, you brought up an interesting point earlier about some districts having their credit rating downgraded. But before we get to that, Governor Ivey did also make another interesting statement that she's aiming to have the highest paid teachers in the surrounding states. How is she looking to accomplish that? Because I see that the issue of school choice could be siphoning funding away from public schools, but in the same breath, she's looking to have the highest paid teachers. You know, I guess two questions. One, how is she planning to do that? I'm guessing that's through state funding. And two, what is the implication now with that buttressed with school choice?
It's just with everything, you have to make sure you're creating a program that can be sustained.
So is she looking to funnel more state funding to public schools to have higher paid teachers? I mean, what is that mechanism?
Yeah, so I assume that's that. I have not actually seen it in the bill yet, but I mean, the only way to do that is that there's a state minimum teacher salary there that the state funds, and so there's been a lot of structural changes to the teacher matrix, which I think is good, and I think that's what we need to do to try to address some of the teacher shortages.
Yeah, you want to attract more to the profession too, right?
There's been some innovative approaches that I think have been absolutely been working in Alabama. There was a big shortage of math and science teachers. And so one of the provisions that they did is they created they called it the TEAMS contract. And so if you're a math or you're a science teacher and you meet the criteria there, then you can become contracted. And it resulted in almost an extra $20,000 a year in salary. But one of the provisions there is that you waive your tenure rights under Students First Act in Alabama, but I thought that was good. I mean, again, if you're a good, strong teacher, why not get more money and not have to be reliant on a structure that, for the most part, rewards people that are not doing a good job? So, there have been some innovative things that have happened in Alabama that have definitely helped, but. Again, we just have to go back, and there's been safeguards and there's safety accounts and other things that have been added in Alabama. But if you kind of go back to, 2006, 2007, 2008, you saw Alabama gave massive raises. They gave massive raises. They would go raises over and above with the revenue that was coming in. And then the recession, the Great Recession hit, and then there was 3 to 4 years of proration, and So again, when you make these decisions, make sure you don't put school systems into a situation where there's proration, because proration's terrible. I mean, you're hiring teachers in the summer, everything's good. And then all of a sudden the State Department goes, oh shoot, you know, we did a miscalculation on our revenue here. And, we're going to have to cut your funding in the middle of the year by, you know, 10, 11, 12%, those type things. And school systems are having to lay people off. It's massive disruption. So if you're going to do it, make sure it's sustainable. Make sure you're really calculating that.
Sustainability is a big question of mine when I hear some of these lofty goals. My immediate red flag when, you know, we were listening to Governor Ivey kind of lay out her plan for 24, where's the money coming from, John? I mean, is it, you have an influx of people coming into the state? Is it sales tax? I mean, where is the sustainable revenue coming for these education saving programs for school choice, highest paid teachers in the surrounding states? Where's the money?
So to make it even more scary, if you look at a lot of states, I mean, they're ad valorem driven as far as what's funds. And ad valorem is more of a stable driven funding source. In Alabama, it's coming from two areas. It's coming from sales tax and it's coming from income tax. It's one of those situations where when times are good, times are great. When times are bad, things are really bad. It's one of those revenue sources that's very volatile. And so, you know, and in Baldwin County, we live and breathe off sales tax too. And you have to make sure you have the right cushion, the right reserves, all that in place to make sure you can handle any unexpected dips in your revenue and those type things. And so
do you have a lot of industry in Baldwin County?
We are growing industry. And in fact, we actually have a big manufacturing plant that's in construction in North Baldwin County, which is, you know, going to be one of the biggest in the state. I think a $4 billion investment there. But previously, it's been smaller industry. It's been a lot of residential. It's been tourism-based. I mean, again, in Baldwin County, we have the beaches down there. And so a lot of tourism came in. And that's why in Baldwin County, sales tax has worked, because that is beneficial when you can do that. But just like in Baldwin County, Alabama is reliant on two very volatile income streams. And so if you have a downturn in the economy, all of a sudden, that money dries up extremely, extremely fast. I know, and you know, in Baldwin County, going back, this is, you know, I started here in 2012, so God, you know, I wasn't here at that point in time. But I mean, in 2010 in Baldwin County, you had proration from the state, you had the Great Recession, and then you had the BP oil spill that happened, and it was like the trifecta of chaos in Baldwin County that just wreaked havoc. And they went from having probably a 2 to 3 month reserve to no reserve, to laying off 1,200 people in 1 year, to pull a line of credit to meet payroll and those type things. And so, you know, I do think that, you know, in Baldwin County, I never want to forget the past and where we came from, because I never want to have to repeat that, the disruption and what it took to come back from that. And I think Alabama needs to continue to think about that as well. Don't ever forget about what happened during the Great Recession, those type things. And again, there have been mechanisms and there have been things in place to increase the reserves and those type things. But again, everything we do, we need to think about it from a long-term sustainability perspective. What happens if we see a 10% drop in income or this? Are we going to be able to maintain this? What programs are going to be cut? Those type of things. We just got to, you know, just like we do locally here, just like you do at your, you know, when you're managing your household budget, we just have to think about those type of things. And so I think all of that, you know, is a bigger discussion when you're, you know, a lot of different things have happened. You're looking at school choice in Alabama. You're looking at increasing teacher salaries. They cut a 1% in the grocery sales tax. And you know, I think putting sales tax on groceries is a very regressive tax and those type things. But at the same time, if you're going to cut the grocery sales tax, what are you going to replace it with?
Right.
We got a situation where you're cutting taxes, you're increasing programs, you're making promises and commitments. Are you going to be able to sustain that over the long term?
Yeah, it sounds like times are good in Alabama right now. But like you said, you have to plan and learn from the past. So who knows what the next 5-10 years are going to look like. And as you just laid out, cutting sales tax is great as an individual in the state, I'm sure, but are you cutting it in a sustainable way where you're going to make that up from somewhere else? You know, it sounds like we don't know right now.
Yeah, I think you have a lot of systems. I think I was one of the few systems in Alabama that, you know, you had an influx of federal funds to the COVID relief, you know, ESSER 1, ESSER 2, ARP, ESSER 3. They hired personnel. I was probably putting my foot down and I said, you know, I'm not going to do that. That's a short-term funding source. Right. You know, you hire them in a full-time basis. They're tenured in 3 years and they're yours. You own them. And so you have a situation where a lot of school systems in Alabama hired a lot of personnel using their federal funds under the assumption that, oh, you know, this person will retire. When they retire, I'll be able to move their funding source to state funding, something like that. Well, what happened is that, you know, the state changed the teacher matrix and they increased the salaries for teachers substantially. And so a lot of teachers that may have been on the cusp of thinking about retiring and those type of things were like,
they might as well stick around a few more years, right?
Exactly. If I can stay about three more years, that's going to be a pretty material impact to my retirement. Well, guess what? They're now tenured. They're still there. And your funding drops off in just a few months.
And I'm sure when the ESSER funds came out, nobody was even thinking that the state would maybe increase the teacher pay, right? So making those lofty assumptions are pretty risky.
So you're going to have a lot of, you know, a lot of school systems, and I've talked to a lot of my peers that are like, what are we going to do? You know, again, how are we going to address this? And then, you know, it's difficult. I mean, the staffing was what's needed, and it gets political, especially if, you know, if you've used that to hire nursing and other stuff, the funding goes away, you're having to make difficult decisions. And so you kind of have that in the background going on right now in Alabama. Right. And so with that potentially going on, the big push on student choice, the cutting of the grocery tax, the increasing teacher salaries. There was a provision last session, too, that basically said you can't pay anybody less than $15 an hour, which I thought was a kind of an interesting provision there. You know, in Baldwin County, just because of where we live and you know, just looking at the comps, we, you know, we were pretty close to that. Mm-hmm. But they pretty much set a minimal, you know, cap of $15 per hour. If you looked at some of these other very, very rural counties, that had a, I mean, all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, I'm going to have to increase my CNP salaries by 40, 50%. I'm going to have to do this 40, 50%. The funding wasn't associated with it. And then just the overall economic impact of that area where you may have had people working at, you know, their local hardware store or restaurant and making this, they're now coming to the school system, which is good for them. Now the school system's like, oh crap, I don't think I can pay it. So then they're having to lay that off. And so there's a ripple effect from a lot of decisions. And I, you know, so many times these things get pushed through, you know, I'll see the Education Trust Fund bill when it's first introduced, we'll read it. And then after all the amendments and last minute things and all, you know, and you're like, oh my God, what did they added last year? What did they added here? What did they added there? Who's talking? Who's, you know, who's pushing this? But there are ripple effects and implications across the state of Alabama that I don't necessarily think are properly thought through, you know? Right.
I mean, that example, increasing the minimum wage to 15 makes sense if there's a corresponding revenue to back it up, right?
Well, it makes sense based on the area. So, I mean, you have certain areas, Birmingham and Huntsville, you know, even down here in some of the areas that just have a higher just, you know, average cost of living. Yeah. And those, you have other areas in the state that do not, and they have had declining population. And if you look at some of the comps on those type of things, it does not align to that. So it creates a very kind of interesting kind of economic study of that when you push these mandates down without looking at the local impact of where you're pushing it, it's not a one-size-fits-all model, just doesn't work. And so just kind of a lot of interesting things.
Yeah, I would say so. And the kind of the final thing I want to bring up is a point you had made a couple times earlier about the impact of school choice on public schools and the credit rating. That is something I hadn't read about or wasn't aware of. So it's fascinating that Moody's is downgrading districts because of school choice, essentially, because I'm assuming it's less of a tax base, it's less enrollment. So they're not looking at these districts as being as financially strong as they once were. What are you seeing in Alabama and with your peers? How are they dealing with these downgrades of their credit rating, and how is that going to impact their capital planning moving forward?
I think that, you know, I don't know if, you know, this was a kind of a statewide Reuters report. And I think this came out actually in, I think, 2013. So, I mean, this has been an ongoing thing with Alabama being relatively new to the charter schools and, you know, it really kind of growing more than it has, but it's still not nearly to the extent of other states. I don't know if you've seen anybody with that direct impact on their rating age. Maybe you have. I haven't seen a customized Alabama, you know, report on the rating ages and those kind of things. But it is, you know, you think about it, you know, especially with interest rates the way they are right now, in order to go to the bonding market or do something for your capital needs, and you know, and it's not necessarily because you're growing. You see a lot of school systems aging facilities, that has aging facilities, absolutely, and then the you know, or some of their facilities may not meet all the disability requirements that you need to do. That you need to be upgrades in there. There are ways that you can put more energy efficient things into your buildings, and so there's a lot of different reasons to do that. And so, interest rates right now are very difficult to begin with, and then if you bring a downgrade into your credit rating, and so that you know you become in their eyes a more risky investment, the interest rates are going to increase even more, which is going to create more strain on some of these struggling school districts that maybe have school buildings that are 50, 60, 70 years old. They know they need to increase it. There's a lot of issues there, but because of that, you know, and money being funneled into other areas, that's another very interesting thing. And it's also, you know, unfortunate when you're trying the best you can to try to utilize your resources and make it spread as far as you possibly can. You have things that happen that are completely outside of your control that just make the spreading of resources even more difficult. So I thought that was very interesting as well.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. I wasn't aware of that. And just, you know, you read about all these issues with school choice, but at least my radar wasn't set on downgrading of your credit rating. I mean, the cost of money is as tough as it is. So to have a downgraded rating makes it even more challenging, as you were saying. But winding down here, I mean, just given all that we've talked about today, and you've really given our listeners a lot to think about and a lot of great information, are you and your administrative staff really kind of keeping your eye on how school choice could impact Baldwin County schools? And what are your conversations kind of like these days?
I think you have to. I think, you know, in the, you know, it just... From my personal perspective, you know, in the past, you know, I've gone up and I've spoken at committee meetings and I've done other things when they've come up with school choice bills that were just straight terrible. The Price Act last year, there's no way to defend that. That was just a terrible bill. The Choice Act this year at least has the right guardrails that's livable. But when I'd go up there and I talk about it, it's like me and one other person.
Really?
And so you're not seeing the districts that are
like you said, where's the outrage, right?
Where are they? You know, again, you know, they're so terrified of what's going to happen, but they're also terrified to go up there and speak the truth about what's happening in Baldwin, you know, and so I've been a little bit frustrated at some of my peers. Again, guys, we need to be a collective front on this stuff. It's going to impact you far worse than me. I mean, we've done a lot of things in Baldwin County to increase our local revenue. We've done a lot of things to manage it, to build reserves, to do those type of things. So after spending so much time fighting everybody from the state and no one else really jumping in behind me to be like, yes, thank you, I've kind of shifted to where, you know, I'm back to protecting Baldwin County and making sure that we can we have the reserve balance, we're managing our financials in the appropriate manner so we can handle unexpected dips in the economy, unexpected hits to the education trust fund, those type of things. You have to do it. So you couple that with growing to the extent of an elementary school per year, and it just kind of does create a interesting situation that you have to look at. But I mean, I think that we need to see, it's just been quiet. I mean, you know, you go to these things, you see the same organizations, you see the same statewide groups, but they hear from them all the time. If you really want to be impactful, you need to go up there. You need to talk to your legislator. You need to clearly explain the situations that you're currently in. You need to clearly explain the disruptions that COVID's involved. You need to clearly explain the health issues that you're having to deal with. I mean, the health issues at the school have gone up exponentially. They don't even fund a nurse in every school in Alabama, but yet you have kids with trachs and feeding tubes and all these kind of things. That is the information that needs to get out there. But it's not. It's very strange to me. So anyway, I kind of got off on my soapbox there. But you know, I just, you know, they're you know, again, everyone wants to complain. What are we going to do? What did you do proactively to try to make people understand the situation that you're currently in? And there's just not enough of that in the state of Alabama.
Yeah, advocacy and information is so powerful. And if you don't have enough voices, kind of rallying around a unified message. You see a lot of people kind of just throwing their hands up in the air, like, listen, I can only do so much, right?
Yeah. I mean, you have people that are like, if that happens, I'm just going to retire. Right. You know, I'm like, come on now. You know, I think about it from a bigger global perspective and think about the impact. You know, my kids are in in the public school system. My wife works for the public school system. It's personal. We've also, we've gone through a lot of funding issues, challenges. I think we went through almost four referendums in a 5-year period to stabilize our funding. We've done a lot of things in Baldwin County unique to us that basically created the circumstances that we're in where we can do $500 million of construction, or we can do the equivalents of construction. But there wasn't anyone from the state or the feds to help us with that. We had to figure it out ourselves. We had to roll up our sleeve. We had to come up with innovative solutions. We had to do these type of things. And so there needs to be more innovative people that they need to think about it. What can I do? Don't just complain about it, but what can I do to proactively get in front of it and address it? And there's just a massive lack of that in Alabama. So.
Yeah. Well, John, I appreciate your enthusiasm, your foresight, and your passion for the industry. I mean, this has been an absolutely fascinating conversation. And it sounds like you have a lot on your plate in Alabama. So
absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining me today on School Business Insider, and best of luck moving forward.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to School Business Insider. Make sure to check back each week for your favorite topics on school business.